I would talk about colonialism as one of the phases of imperialism or potential phases of imperialism. And colonialism and I think the accompanying colonization, I would say, refer to both the formal and the informal methods. And that just means the behaviors, the ideologies, the institutions, policies, and economies that maintain the subjugation or exploitation of indigenous peoples, lands, and resources. And one of the ways that I tend to distinguish colonization from colonialism is that colonialism is really about implementing that situation of subjugation and complete control over another population. And so it involves that invasion process when a population's leaders, for example, might be killed, the resistors are killed or disabled in some manner, and then a system of control is implemented. Sometimes that begins as economic control. Other times it's a very physical and very brutal control or threat of with a constant threat of violence. But once that situation is under control, then colonization is really about what happens in terms of how that control is maintained generation after generation, decade after decade, century after century. And I would say that right now we're in this phase of colonization precisely because every generation has to keep this system going. And anytime indigenous populations step out of line, we're quickly whipped back into shape and are forced to adhere to the laws and rules of colonizing society. So that's one way that I see it.
So just to take it further, when you talk about, put them back in line and things like that, so what institutions are really being used to do that on a regular basis in today's world?
Well, I think it's done in all kinds of ways. I think the most obvious way is through the use of the military and use of law enforcement. So the criminal injustice system is what I call it. And so that's a very physical kind of concrete way that law and order, according to colonizing society, is maintained. But I also think that there are many more subtle ways that really begin with the colonization of the mind with indigenous children, and even children from settler society as well, from the time that they're born. It's all of the messages from popular culture, it's the educational system, it's the social welfare system, it's the economic system. All of those systems work to make us believe that, first of all, that there's only one way, and that's the way of the dominant society, and that way is superior to every other way. And so for us to even imagine a way out is ridiculous because this is the way of life that's normal, that's the best, that represents the pinnacle of civilization. And it really is, I think, a matter of those boundaries that are imposed on us from the time that we're very small that are the hardest in some ways to break through. Because the other things, like you can see a police officer, you can see the handcuffs, you can feel the handcuffs, you can experience being behind bars in a very physical way. But what's much harder to acknowledge and realize and I think fight against is the bars that are placed on our minds and the parameters of action that are constrained by those bars.
I think it brings another thought, and then one of the things that how, in a lot of ways, there's a sort of a systemic racism within the concept of civilization, in that it is the only way to live, and other ways to live weren't valid. They weren't valid in their arts or their culture. Because you hear a lot of people say, "Oh, well, we have to save civilization because it provided us so many good things," and yet there seems to be something being dismissed in that same statement.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. And it's so pervasive that most of us learn to never even see it. It's completely invisible. And one of the things that I when I was teaching American history courses, we would spend a lot of time deconstructing the notion of progress, because the notion of progress, I think, is inherently racist and colonialist. And and even though it violates the sensibilities of many modern American or Canadian citizens today to look at indigenous cultures as barbaric, as savage, they would be reluctant to use those terms in reference to indigenous populations. But by adhering to an idea like progress, or believing in an idea like progress, that's exactly what they're doing, because progress is really based on this notion that there's, a linear progression, but that civilizations have moved through these phases from barbarism to the civilizations that we have today. And the assumption behind that is that indigenous societies who didn't live in civilizations like Europeans, because many of us maintained hunting and gathering lifestyles, subsistence lifestyles for many thousands of years, that there is something kind of inherently flawed with us, or that we're behind everyone else, and that if given the proper amount of time, we would eventually evolve to become what this society has become, so that it's a natural evolution. Right. But that kind of thinking is really very flawed, because I think that, for example, as Dakota people, if we were to adhere to our way of life, our traditional teachings, which are really about respectful relations with all of creation, about maintaining a sense of balance, that there might be times when we deviate from that and have to work towards that again, but that our goal was never some idea of progress. We weren't chasing some kind of so-called advanced civilization or way of living. What we were seeking was something very different, and that was balance. So even if we had another 10,000 years, I don't think ever would have chosen this path that we've all been forced on today. So I think that a lot of the ideas embedded in this society are inherently racist and colonialist, for that matter.
Yeah, that's really good. I mean, well said. because it's something that keeps going through my mind, and you bring it up, is that the whole idea of progress, and that's the whole thing right there. It's this whole idea of progress is the only way to go. And you can see it just in the concepts of the toys people have from, they have the iPhone and this phone and that phone, and how it's progressed, and how that's progress, and that's how things are supposed to be. How can you have that old thing when you should have this new thing? Yeah, it's riddled through everything. It's amazing.
And it's hard to fight on a daily basis.
Yeah.
It's hard to constantly bump up against that without having some of that thinking or some of the values inherent in that thinking rub off on you.
What particular institutions are involved? And I think you've touched on talking about the education system, subtle ones. Are there any others that sort of come to mind, or does that sort of cover that one pretty well?
Right. No, I mean, the things that I mentioned, the economic system certainly mm-hmm. is one that's been extraordinarily harmful and continues to be extraordinarily harmful, because it drives the civilization right now. And mm-hmm. all of us, I think, are caught up in it, even indigenous populations, as much as many of us have tried to resist the influences. We're all part of it today. And in fact, we can't function, or haven't been able to function, outside of capitalism in many generations, if not centuries, for some of us. So it's the capitalist system, it's the education system, social welfare, education, it's all of those things combined, the government system,
right.
criminal injustice, everything.
Right. When I was reading your article, Colonialism on the Ground, you talked about language, and you bring up some points that I hadn't really thought of before, because I think language is, you sort of equate language with culture. And I'm learning Cree because I live in a Cree area. And,
excellent.
And, the teacher reminds me, said, well, you live in a Cree territory, you have to learn Cree. And I believe that, so I'm learning Cree. But you bring up a point that the misplaced argument for indigenous resiliency occurs in the area of language. And can you sort of explain that further?
Right. When I wrote this piece, I was, I think, particularly responding to some of the latest scholarship in the last several decades, or at least a couple decades, in the field of indigenous history. And I'm a historian by training, and so a lot of my education, a lot of my reading initially was in histories, how people, as scholars, writers, interpret or tell the stories of indigenous history and indigenous white relations. And there was a lot of, as we all know, I think that a lot of the histories were quite racist throughout the 19th century, throughout much of the 20th century. And it was really only at the end of the 20th century that you started to see a different wave of narrative about indigenous history and indigenous white relations emerge. And that narrative was labeled the New Indian History, which really was dedicated to focusing on, rather than indigenous victimage, focusing instead on indigenous agency and resiliency. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I definitely understand the reasons for that, but I also think that what it has served to do is to mask the effects of colonialism. And I think that that is extraordinarily damaging. And when I would read those histories, because I had to read a lot of them, especially in graduate school, they just rubbed me the wrong way. They just, in my gut, I knew they didn't feel right, but I couldn't quite, at that point, pinpoint why, what it was that felt so wrong. And right. So it's only within, I would say, the last decade or so that I've been able to think about that, or at least articulate some of my feelings about that. And part of it is that when you spend your time focusing on agency and vibrancy, it takes away the horror of the indigenous experience in the Western Hemisphere. And, for example, even with our populations, you'll hear, and I think indigenous people, we've been trained to talk like this. We've been trained to focus on our agency and resiliency, partly because it's too depressing to focus on anything else, right. But partly because we get this message from settler society as well. So you'll hear indigenous people say, we're survivors, we're still here, and it's oftentimes said with a kind of defiance and a real sense of pride. And on the one hand, I really understand that, but if we keep the focus of our attention on the people who have survived, what about the 98.5% of our populations who didn't survive? What does it say about that particular story? And I feel fortunate that I'm one of the survivors. I feel lucky. There's a certain defiance, obviously, that I feel as someone who's still resisting in the 21st century. But at the same time, a big part of me grieves every single day for the losses our people have suffered, and they have been very serious losses. Mm-hmm. And we've learned to accept the pain and the grief as something completely normal. In fact, most people, I would say, in my community, including myself at times, we've just learned to put blinders on, or to, to ignore or suppress that pain, because we can't dwell there all the time. And so it's the same kind of thing with language. You know, at one point, 100% of our population was fluent in our language. And now in my community, I think we have 6 fluent speakers of our language left.
Wow.
And less than 10 fluent speakers in the state of Minnesota.
Wow.
And that's absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And so today, the kind of the New Indian History take, and it's the perspective, I think, pushed by settler society because it's more comfortable. It's more comforting to hear that Indians are doing fine and well in the 21st century. And so the tendency is to celebrate these things. And absolutely, if we have a language program and we're working on reviving our languages, we have to celebrate those things. We have to take joy where we can, and we have to encourage our young people to continue learning our languages and recovering traditional knowledge, because I think it will very much help us in the future. But at the same time, if we take the broad view of history, it's very clear that when we go from 100% of fluency down to, you know, 0.001% or whatever it is, I haven't done the math on that, there's no comparison to those two figures, and it is absolutely clear that we have suffered a tremendous loss.
Yeah.
And so that's why, for me, focusing on something like resiliency or vibrancy and agency really masks a lot of the pain, a lot of the suffering, and a lot of the loss that I think we can't afford to overlook, and we have to be honest with ourselves about where things are right now, I think, if nothing else, so that we can come up with more effective strategies to combat that reality.
Just as a thought, I mean, to go forward, how do you see, you know, batting some of that? Because the other thing, I mean, language is a big part of one of the things I see disappearing. My partner's mother went through the residential school system. She spoke only her language when she went in. She doesn't remember any of it now. It was quite literally beaten out of her. Because at the same time, I also see the ceremonies and things like that. There's very few young people at the ceremonies, very few young people learning those things as well.
Right. You know, well, I think one of the things, and this I think it ties into the issue of agency and resiliency and what this means, is that a recognition of colonialism really allows a certain amount of liberation, because it, in some ways, frees us of the blame and the guilt and stuff that we feel. And nowhere is this more true, I think, than in the area of language, because we have generations of our people who were sent away to boarding schools or residential schools. And like you said, the language was literally beaten out of our relatives. And those survivors, when they came home and they had their own children and they had to decide what language they were going to teach their children, most of the survivors of boarding schools chose not to teach their children our indigenous languages. And it wasn't because they hated our kids or even because they hated our cultures. It was out of love, because they didn't want their children to experience the same kind of pain that they went through. And when we take the time to acknowledge what colonization has done to our people and what this systematic process of ethnocide has done to our people, then we can forgive one another, and we can also set aside some of the shame. Because I know, you know, my grandmother went to boarding school, and she remembered her language. She was a fluent speaker. And then when it got to her children, the older ones, she taught the language. The younger, when she saw that they had problems in school, she switched to English largely. So the younger ones don't speak as well as the older kids in that generation. And then when it came to my generation, the language wasn't really taught at all. We knew words and phrases, and for me, it wasn't really until I became an adult that I started studying the language, and that became important to me. But for people in my generation, there's a certain amount of shame that we feel because we don't fluently speak our languages. And I think that a recognition of colonialism and its impact allows us to say it's not our fault. It's not our parents' fault. It's not our grandparents' fault. That at each step, people made the best decisions that they could under the circumstances, and the choices were really horrendous. It wasn't a choice between good and bad, between right and wrong. It was a choice between which is worse, or which is less worse. Do we teach our children our language, something that is beloved to us, and watch them get tortured and abused and teased and mistreated because of that? And that's a really hard choice for a parent to make. You know, none of us wants our children to suffer. It's even worse than suffering ourselves. We don't want our young ones to suffer. So every generation has been put in a really difficult position. And so when we acknowledge that, we can be more generous with one another. And I think it also can help instill in the young people a real desire to recover then what was lost, that what was really taken from us in a very tragic way. And that recovery then also becomes a form of resistance, but it's acknowledged as resistance. And as every time you engage in some act of resistance, you get stronger. And your desire for justice, I think, becomes stronger, and you become more empowered in that process. So I think in that way that we have the capacity to turn what is a horrendous situation and has been a horrendous history into a pathway for empowerment for the current and future generations.
How has colonialism affected Indigenous women?
Oh, that's a
question.
Yeah, it is. And it's an important question. I think one of the writers who has really impacted this discussion is a scholar named Andrea Smith, who wrote a book called Conquest, Sexual Violence and American Indian Genocide. And one of the things that she argues is that colonial relationships are themselves gendered and sexualized. And so colonialism itself is not equal in terms of gender, that it is inherently, fundamentally gendered and sexualized. And she says that sexual violence is a tool by which certain peoples become marked as inherently rapable. These peoples then are violated not only through direct or sexual assault, but through a wide variety of state policies ranging from environmental racism to sterilization abuse and things like that. So I think that this has been a very important argument in discussions about colonialism and especially the experiences of Indigenous women today and this idea of being rapable, because I think that most Indigenous peoples across the board, one of the things that we feel very much is that the same kinds of things that happen to our people have also happened to our lands, and that if we identify ourselves as being Indigenous in the most basic and fundamental sense, that we are coming from the land, we have come from the land, that we're actually part of the land, then you can see why, you can see the connections in a really powerful way in terms of the way we've been treated and how we're all trying to heal today from ongoing exploitation, ongoing violence, ongoing assault. Right. And then in the last year or so, there's been also a lot of discussion about the really outrageous statistics regarding Indigenous women, I think both in the United States and Canada. And in the United States, the latest figures are that 1 in 3 Indian women in the United States is raped in her lifetime, mm-hmm. and that 3 in 5 Native women will be victims of violent assault. And mm-hmm. so it's talked about as an epidemic of violence, and we see that how much of this violence is swept under the rug. We know that here in the United States that about 85% of the rapes that are perpetrated on reservations are perpetrated by non-Indians. And so that means that even these places that are supposed to be our places, right, the reservations, mm-hmm. are being kind of infiltrated uh-huh. by non-Indigenous people and largely by white men who then continue to treat us as rapeable objects, as beings to assault. So wow. colonialism, you know, when we, it's all tied together. And I'm mm-hmm. not someone who is necessarily focused on gender a lot in my analysis, but I am definitely drawn into what I think is a very compelling argument here, that as Indigenous populations and as non-Indigenous populations, that we really have to address patriarchy. We really have to address the connection between patriarchy and colonialism. And we really need to look at this issue of domination and hierarchy and oppression, I think, which is inherent in the colonial structure. And I think it's why so many activists, I think, are really working hard to make the links between, anti-statist, anti-patriarchal, anti-oppression movements. It's really important.
In your article, you talked about water and you talked about the buffalo. And so I'm just wondering if you want to take that a little further and sort of layer in how the environment really is all fits into that whole picture. Because I think some people view it as separate things, and I don't think that you can, myself personally, that everything is intertwined, and ultimately it's really the environment that's got to be healthy so everything else can be healthy. But that's just sort of my thoughts on it, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that, and it's clear that the society, these societies, I should say, if we're talking about the United States and Canada, it's hard for me to distinguish between them most of the time, quite honestly.
Well, yeah, because you live part time in Canada when you're working in Victoria, right?
I do.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think although you know many Canadian hackles would rise to hear this, in a lot of ways there are subtle differences, but for the most part, as far as how we function as a society, I tend towards thinking that Canada is far riper for a fascist type regime than the U.S. is, just because of how easily we capitulate to government and government decisions.
I would say that my perspective wavers back and forth, depending upon the day. But I definitely see a lot of similarities and a definite sharing of values.
Yeah, definitely.
And those values really allow for the complete exploitation and of the natural world. Mm-hmm. That everything is still about money. Everything is still about corporate profits and greed, and a disregard for the damage that it causes to relationships. Well, and I think fundamental to that is a disbelief on the part of the mainstream societies about the life that's all around us. Even seeing the earth as alive, even seeing animals as worthy of consideration and respect, or the plants, and it's a fundamentally different worldview that's really hard for me to understand, even though I've grown up in it my whole life. You know, I face it every day, and it still blows me away. I still am stunned at the disregard for life that I see every day. You know, this weekend, the river that runs through my home community and the Upper Sioux Reservation in southwestern Minnesota is the Minnesota River, and it's a beloved river to our people. And it's really been heartbreaking watching what's happened to this river. That at the headwaters of the Minnesota River is Big Stone Power Plant, which is a coal-burning power plant, and all of the emissions, either through air or dumped into the water, everything ends up downstream, downwind and downgrade. And where we're situated in this area around Granite Falls and Montevideo is where a lot of the toxins settle, including things like mercury. And so this particular area has a high concentration of toxic fish and all the plant life, and all of the other beings that feed off of the fish are all in danger of toxicity because of the way that this river has been polluted. And now the Minnesota River is known or is acknowledged or recognized as one of the 10 most endangered rivers in the United States.
Wow.
And this weekend there was just a report that came out was a newspaper article that talked about the Minnesota River Basin and how 90% of the landscape in this area is farmed. And, of course, this is an area that our population was initially pushed out of largely by white farmers, people who wanted to live that agrarian ideal. But what they have done to this landscape is so absolutely appalling. 90% of the wetlands have been drained.
Wow.
99% of the prairies are gone. And you see corn, soybeans, and sugar beets all throughout this area. Like every square inch of land that can be tilled and planted with corn and soybeans is planted with corn and soybeans. And so they really remade the landscape. And then we have all of the runoff, the pesticides, the fertilizers that go right into the water basin. And it's horrific. And we just, as a people, you know, we get really overwhelmed, I guess I would say, by the magnitude of the problem. You know, how do you begin? How do you begin to address these things? And yet, at the same time, as indigenous populations, we are raised with the belief that, you know, we have a profound connection to this particular land base, that it's our obligation to protect the land, that it's our obligation to maintain good relations with all of creation in this particular landscape. Yet, what are we doing? We're in such small communities, and we're really quite, we feel quite powerless to take action against big corporations, against the government, against even the white populations that surround us. And so we're, it feels like right now that we're stuck in a very difficult place. At the same time, time is running out, and I think that, that every year, as things get more polluted, as the earth becomes more toxic, as corporations continue to dump all of their waste and you know, do damage to the environment, that we're at a point where we're going to need actually to move beyond that sense of powerlessness and engage in a struggle again more actively in defense of the earth.